We celebrate Palm Sunday because about 2,000 years ago, Jesus Christ, as the Lamb of God, entered into Jerusalem, went into the temple, taught, shortly after that was arrested, and as the Lamb of God, his blood was shed on our behalf because of God's great mercy to us. And the song that we sang here earlier had a wonderful phrase in it. And so let me just give you a little bit of the history of that. And this is all additional free stuff. I'm just putting a little extra in here. But it just occurred to me that, you know, when it came to the worship of the Jews in Palestine at that time, it all began at first with the tabernacle. And the tabernacle had three components to it: the outer court, the inner court, and the Holy of Holies. And the temple that Herod built, which is one of the great architectural pieces of its time, one of the great maybe in all history, the temple that Herod built was patterned after that: the outer court, the holy place, and the Holy of Holies. The outer court, the Gentiles could come into. The holy place was where the Jewish people were allowed into. But the Holy of Holies, the high priest, once a year, took the blood of the Paschal Lamb, the Passover Lamb, and he took that blood in and he scattered it or sprinkled it before the Ark of the Covenant, in which contained the law, Aaron's rod, and the Ten Commandments, or the tablets of God, the law. In the ark. The ark, also known as the mercy seat. It was called the mercy seat. Did you know that? It was also called the mercy seat. That you took the blood on behalf of the people and you sprinkled it on the mercy seat on behalf of... So you wanted mercy. See? And so we're talking about mercy today. And the significance of the mercy of God in our lives, and the significance of how mercy should be a prominent part of our lives with each other as well. And so, as we continue on with this series related to the Sermon on the Mount, I just want to remind you again how important it is to understand that when Jesus was speaking, and he was talking about the Sermon on the Mount, the audience to whom he was speaking to, his disciples, the crowd, the masses, and the religious leaders, and whoever else might have been with them too, who were on the outer periphery. And so Jesus was giving the Sermon on the Mount as a corrective, and as a source of hope for the masses, as a corrective for the religious leaders of his day. He was trying to correct how they implemented the Mosaic Law in the lives of the people, primarily through tradition. And that tradition proved in many cases to be disaster for them as well as for their people. And so we've come to the Beatitudes, and I've gone through several of them, but today I'm going to do mercy, and it's going to sort of like be mercy part two from Matthew 5:6. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. And I mentioned last week how I thought, I sort of admitted to you that mercy was one of those words that I'm not sure I appreciate as much as I've appreciated the word justice. It's not one of those words that I've appreciated as much as I have grace. But mercy, I think I have underplayed in its emphasis in my life. And maybe you have as well. And so I really want to underscore the importance of that, and maybe I can do that a bit more today as we talk about it. So as Jesus is giving these Beatitudes, and he says, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy, you have to think in terms of the audience that he was speaking to. And I sort of gave you a bit, it was sort of the disciples, the masses, and then the religious leaders, and who knows, maybe some Gentiles, maybe some Roman officials on the outer perimeter. I mean, the text doesn't say, but we do know that where Jesus was, those people oftentimes were, almost always were, wherever he was. And so you have to remember that Jesus at that point, when he's talking about blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy, that he was talking to a mass of people who came from all over the place desperate. They were desperate because they were the poorest of the poor. They were sick and diseased. They were lame. They were demon-possessed. And they were desperate. And they needed hope. They needed help. And so they lived in a culture where Roman law was unforgiving. Where the Herodians under Herod were unforgiving. If you broke any of those laws, they were unforgiving. Where the Jewish leaders themselves, who were supposed to be icons of hope, were unforgiving if anybody broke the law in any way, shape, or form. And so here are these people coming from all over the place, this light, because it was the only light there. Because every other power center in their lives was corrupt and were hopeless for them. And so it's no wonder that Jesus attracted a lot of people to himself. And so as Jesus is looking at all these people who are in this kind of a condition, and in many cases, not because it was their fault, but because of the socio-political shenanigans that both the Romans and the Greeks and the Herodians and the religious leaders were playing all the time because of what they did in terms of wars and conflict and things like that. It had a way of pouring itself out on the local people, and they were helpless and they were hurting. And so there's Jesus standing on the mountain, and he's saying, not only to them, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy, but he's speaking through them to all these other people who would have been sort of represented the kind of the power centers of their day. And he's saying to them, look at these people. Be merciful to them. Do you Greeks and Romans understand that when you try to play God with the world, how that really impacts the average person who really cannot defend themselves? Do you religious leaders understand that you possess tremendous knowledge as it relates to Yahweh, to God, and you have the capacity to give these people hope and help and understanding that you can influence, and yet you choose not to because you choose to believe that if they are suffering in any kind of a way, you religious leaders, you choose to believe that if they are suffering, it's because it's their fault. It's because it's a lack of God's favor in their life. And that's all they hear from you. And I am saying to you, Jesus saying, I am saying to you, blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. I think that's a lot of the conversation that was going on at that time. And I think Jesus was working really hard to get the attention of those people. So when we talk about mercy then, what Jesus meant was basically this. The Greek word for mercy, I'm sorry, the Hebrew word for mercy is hesed. And it means when a superior party provides an essential need, not based just on feeling, to a weaker party that the latter could not provide. And so I asked you last week, how many of you have been in a situation where there was somebody who was in a superior position to you who could help you and you could not help yourself? And you might have gotten in that situation because of something that you did. You might have found yourself in that situation because of what someone else did to you, but you were helpless before it, and somebody came along and they showed you mercy. And I bet if I were to ask, I bet if I were to go throughout the room today and ask you, who in your life do you recall being merciful to you? Every one of you could recall who that was and the circumstances that surrounded it, because it made that much of an impact upon you. And because it's so rare that we genuinely receive mercy. And so if I were to ask you in like manner, to whom have you been merciful to? Could you remember some people in your life that could not help themselves and that you chose to inconvenience your life to get in the way of their suffering to help them in some fashion and to be merciful to them? And would they, if I ask them the first question to that person, who has been merciful to you, would they say our name? Would we be one of the first people that would come to mind in that manner? I hope so. When we talk about mercy, there are really two kinds of people. And Jesus was addressing these two kinds of people. He was addressing first those who have sinned, and really because of their sin, they kind of like brought it on themselves. I mean, we do that, don't we? Sometimes we make poor choices and decisions. And when we do that, when we sin, and by the way, let me just say to you, because we occasionally need to be reminded that, again, based on a lot of the conversation that goes on in the culture, there is a thing called sin. There really is. I know that some of you might be surprised because you don't, because it's really fallen out of favor. And even in many churches, the word sin has fallen out of favor. And I just need to say to you, look, if there is no sin, then there's no need for the word redemption. Okay? I realize that maybe some of us want to focus on the word reconciliation. And that's a great word. And that's one of the words that gets at what Jesus did for us. But one of the other words we need to get at is redemption. And you can't really talk about redemption without talking about the word sin. And that when we sin, sometimes there are consequences. Right? And that doesn't mean that if a person sins and they are in the middle of those consequences that we should enjoy that. We should not. We should mourn the fact that there are consequences in a person's life related to their sin. But sometimes there are people who really like to push that and who won't let a person out from under the sin. And so we should be merciful. There's a time when we just need to be merciful, that they've paid enough of a price and we just need to let it go and help them come out from under it and help them deal with the shame and the guilt that comes from that. And I'll show you some examples of that in a few minutes. So there are those who have sinned, and in fact they deserve to suffer, and so there are consequences that are a part of that. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever seen this movie before. How many of you have ever seen the movie? This was, I think, 1986. So I'm really dating myself. The movie called The Mission. How many of you have ever seen that movie? It's a very powerful movie. I would encourage you, if you ever get a chance, to watch it. And I'll just give you a little bit of an overview. The film was done in 1986. Some of the big names, Robert De Niro, Jeremy Irons, Liam Neeson were in this film. It's about Spanish Jesuit priests evangelizing the Guarani Indians in South America. De Niro, the main character in the film, is a slave trader. And he has quite a reputation for going into these areas in South America where they're not supposed to go to capture these Indians and make them slaves. And he's well known among the Indians and feared and despised because of that. But De Niro's wicked life leads him to killing his brother in a duel. And after he kills his brother, he enters into a time of great remorse. And as part of that remorse, he turns to the church. And the church extends mercy to him. And he becomes a Jesuit priest later on. But before that happens, he wants to do some kind of penance. He's horrified by his life. He realizes that being a slave trader and the life of wickedness that he embraced, it really made him a very bad person. And so what he wants to do then is he takes some of the the things that symbolize his life, like the armor that he wore, the sword that he carried, those kinds of things. And he put them in this fishing net, and he drags this fishing net from the village that he's at, and he drags it through the jungle and up this really huge waterfall to where these Indians that he tried to capture and make slaves, to where these Indians were. And then whatever happened there, that's what happened. So that's sort of the story. I want to show this on a video for you. It's relatively short, and then and see what are your feelings when he experiences the Indians who know and fear him in this way. See what you think as he has that particular experience, because I think it's very powerful. And those people who are supposed to allegedly more primitive actually are more sophisticated relationally than what he in fact is. Can we get that up, Christian? Are we good? All right. I think Christian said I should ad lib right now. Oh, here we go. There we go. Can we get the lights back here, Lee? Can you give us more sound? Is that all the sound we can get? Okay. They recognize who he is.
I'm not going to be able to do that.
Is Danera a chameleon or what? I mean, you just never know. But, you know, let me just say this, that sometimes I think that when a person has sin in their life and it catches up to them and they are caught in the jaws of that, some of the most important things that people of faith, that believers in Jesus Christ can do is say, you know, based on what I know about Jesus Christ and His grace and His forgiveness, I just want to say to you, your sins are forgiven you. You know, there's a kind of, there's an absolution that sometimes people need to hear from other people that they trust and love and really look to in terms of how they should feel about themselves and those kinds of situations. And so, this, I think, is an example of that. And it was a powerful thing that the very people that he wronged were the ones who cut his burden free. Right? I have a story going on in my own life right now with a family member. It's unbelievable. And I don't have their permission to tell that story. But someday I want to be able to tell you that story. It's very similar to this. And it's astounding. Just astounding. Number two, there are those who suffer but have not sinned, right? So Jesus was speaking to those people who showed up and maybe they had broken the law and maybe they were murderers or thieves or whatever, and he was speaking to them. But in the same way, there are those people who have done nothing wrong but have had things done to them and suffer as a result of that, whether they lost their fortune or their money or their health or whatever. And so there are those who suffer but have not sinned. And when we encounter those people in our life, the Lord wants us to be merciful to them. If there's a way that we can help, we just did the ladle this past Monday. Look, I don't know all the stories that are there. There are 80 some people there. There are a number of people in this church who know a lot of those people who show up, and I'll tell you this. Some of those people who show up work at fast food restaurants and other places throughout this valley. But they go up there Monday because apparently they have to and they need it. And I don't know if they're there because they've made poor choices. And I don't know if they're there because of how other people made poor choices and now it's visiting itself upon them. I don't know. I just know that when we say that we'll fix you food, that these people show up. It's not for me to judge. And frankly, everyone in this room are just one or two decisions away from being in that same place. Amen. I always used to say to my students when I was a youth minister, you are only one decision away from incarceration. That's all it is. One decision. I remember years ago, in light of, you know, how should we treat people who have had terrible things happen to them through no fault of their own? I mean, I used to eat at this little greasy spoon restaurant called Sneed's. in Lancaster, Ohio, and I would meet with my students there about 6:30 in the morning, and then I'd take them to school about 7:15 or 7:30. And at this particular restaurant, I would just meet on a regular basis. And so one morning while I was walking on my way over to that restaurant, I heard two or three loud bangs. I was about two blocks away. And shortly after that, a bunch of sirens. And so as I walked up to the restaurant, I could see there were ambulances and fire trucks and police cars in the street right next to the restaurant. And I walked up to somebody and I said, "What happened?" You know, and one of the guys said, "Well, apparently there was a woman in the car, and while she was parking her car, she had a jealous boyfriend come up, and he shot her two or three times with a shotgun, point blank, there in the driver's seat of the car, and murdered her there." So, you know, I was like, you know, I mean, I was like 5 minutes away from seeing that, you know. And I walked into Sneed's restaurant, and all of the waitresses were crying because the person who was murdered was one of their fellow waitresses. And I said, "Why are you still here? I mean, I can't believe that you could hardly work under those kinds of, right? Wouldn't you think that?" And the waitress said, "The owner won't let us go. He's making us work. He said, we'll get fired if we leave." That was not merciful. I mean, this was a person that they had worked with for years, that they knew well. And they were devastated by what had just taken place only a few feet from that front door. But the owner was so concerned about the loss of revenue that he made them stay there or else they would be fired. So they needed mercy. And he had no mercy for them. Kenneth Bailey says that showing mercy has two basic meanings. First, it's compassion that is composed of feelings and actions. And second, to be merciful and to obtain mercy are related to forgiving and being forgiven. So when you talk about mercy and forgiveness, it's more than just empathy and it's more than just sympathy. Empathy's close, but it's still not quite there. You know, empathy, you have empathy because you had a similar experience, and so you can feel kind of what that person feels. Sympathy is you just feel badly, but you've not really had that experience. So so for those of us then that have trouble with mercy, we usually have trouble with forgiveness. And if we have trouble with forgiveness, it usually means that we are holding a grudge, that we are remaining angry, that we are being spiteful. And some people will do almost anything to keep another person from feeling good about themselves, because it's just their way of exerting power over them. But that, I think it's pretty clear, biblically speaking, that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. There is that correlation there. So when we are merciful, in many cases we are merciful because we have to be forgiving. There's a dramatic example of that, that when I was doing my study of genocide back in 2002, I studied one particular one called the Rwandan genocide of 1994. There was an article in the New York Times Magazine on this. Rwanda is a nation in the middle of Africa near the Great Lakes region. There are three tribes there. Two dominant tribes, the Hutu and the Tutsi. I've talked with some of you about this before. The Tutsi were sort of tall and thin, lighter skinned, had a more noble bearing. The Hutu, they were herders. The Hutu were shorter, more stout, darker skinned, and they were farmers. And they had years of conflict with each other because of their physical differences and because of the kind of work that they employed. And the nations that colonized them played those up. In 1994, the fastest genocide in the history of humankind took place when between 800,000 and 1 million Tutsi people were systematically cut down, mostly with machetes, by the Hutu tribe. And it was horrific. If you want a good example of that, you could watch the movie Hotel Rwanda. It'll give you a good example of what that was like. In any case, for centuries they've had trouble getting those two ethnic groups together. And so in this particular article, it shows what they call portraits of reconciliation, where they showed a perpetrator, a person who did something evil, a Hutu who did an evil thing to a Tutsi person. And they showed how these two people have come together and have forgiven each other and been merciful. So I'm going to show you three examples just real quick. And you won't be able to read some of it, but I will read it to you because it is astounding. If you knew the kind of devastation that not only visited different people's lives, but the entire neighborhood, the entire region, the whole culture, you have to think about that and take all that into consideration as well. So these people who are reconciling are part of a national program to teach people how to recognize. So the people who agreed to be photographed are part of a continuing international effort towards reconciliation in AMI's program. Small groups of Hutus and Tutsis are counseled over many months, culminating in the perpetrator's formal request for forgiveness. If forgiveness is granted by the survivor, the perpetrator and his family and friends typically bring a basket of offerings, usually food, sorghum, and banana beer. I've never heard of banana beer in my life. I don't know what that would be like, but the accord is sealed with a song and dance. So going back to what Bailey said about mercy, that mercy is compassion that is composed of feelings and actions, here is an example of this particular family. Go on to the next slide, if you would. This is Francois and Epiphany. And by the way, if you're kind of wondering why do they have sort of like West-sounding names, it's because Rwanda was settled by the Belgians, and the Belgians have a heavy French culture influence on them, and so that's why a lot of these names are like that. Can you hear me? Just went out. We good now? Sorry, how about that? Okay, this is Natumbera. This is the perpetrator. This is the person who did part of the genocide. Because of the genocide perpetrated in 1994, he says, I participated in the killing of the son of this woman. We are now members of the same group of unity and reconciliation. We share in everything. If she needs some water to drink, I fetch some for her. There is no suspicion between us, whether under sunlight or during the night. I used to have nightmares, recalling the sad events I have been through, but now I can sleep peacefully, and when we are together, we are like brother and sister. No suspicion between us. This is her response, this next one. He killed my son. Then he came to ask me pardon. I immediately granted it to him because he did not do it by himself. He was haunted by the devil. I was pleased by the way he testified to the crime instead of keeping it in hiding, because it hurts if someone keeps hiding a crime he committed against you. That's that absolution thing that I was telling you about. Before, when I had not yet granted him pardon, he could not
come close to me. I treated him like my enemy, but now I would rather treat him like my own child. Here's another, they're not a couple, but this is Dominique and Cancelled, I think is the name, Cancelled. So the perpetrator said, "The day I thought of asking pardon, I felt unburdened and relieved. I had lost my humanity because of the crime I committed, but now I am like any human being." And this is her response. "After I was chased from my village and Dominic and others looted it, I came home. I became homeless and insane. Later, when he asked my pardon, I said, 'I have nothing to feed my children. Are you going to help raise my children? Are you going to build a house for them?' The next week, Dominic, the perpetrator, came with some survivors and former prisoners who perpetrated the genocide. There were more than 50 of them, and they built my family a house. Ever since then, I have started to feel better. I was like a dry stick. Now I feel peaceful in my heart, and I share this peace with my neighbors." In terms of forgiving and being forgiven, the other component that Bailey talks about, here's this particular couple, Laurent and Beatrice. Laurent says, "I participated in destroying her house because we took the owner for dead. The houses that remained without owners, we thought it was better to destroy them in order to get firewood. Her forgiveness proved to me that she is a person of pure heart," which, by the way, is the next one on the Beatitudes. "Blessed are you who are pure of heart," right? And his response was, her response was, "If I am not stubborn, life moves forward. When someone comes close to you without hatred, although horrible things happened, you welcome him and grant what he is looking for from you. Forgiveness equals mercy." Now, there might be some of you here who say, "There's just no way I could do that." And that might be true. You really don't know what you can or cannot do until you're in that situation. But I can tell you one thing, that what you may have to do in the future is more possible when you practice it a lot better in the here and now. Does that make sense to you? What you may have to do in the future, be merciful in some magnanimous, huge way, might be more possible if we practice it better in the here and now. So we read then in Luke's version of the Beatitudes where he says, "Be merciful just as your Father is merciful." I think that some of us who struggle with mercy have forgotten just how merciful God has been to us. And you think, well, what do you mean by that? Well, I'll tell you what I mean. I mean that the call to worship that Bev read about the unmerciful servant, right? That unmerciful servant went before his master and said, "Please forgive me the debt that I owe you." And that debt was enormous. In fact, here's how big the debt was. You really can't get a dollars to talents, 10,000 talents comparison, but you can do this. That 10,000 talents that he owed the master, you would need 150,000 days, 150,000 years of wages to pay off. 150,000 years of wages to pay off that debt. And Jesus' point is clear, that this servant here owed a debt that he could never repay. And that in owing that debt, he should expect some kind of terrible consequence, that not only would he pay for it, but his entire family as well. You and I, before Christ, owed a debt that we could never repay. It was impossible for us to do that. And there was no amount of work, there was no degree of sincerity that would have ever rescued us. And so the Master, that is God, is merciful. And through Jesus Christ on the cross, our sins and our debts are forgiven us. A debt that we could never repay. And so when the unmerciful servant then goes out and he grabs another servant who owes him a small amount of money, a week's worth of wages, the master's like, well, wait a minute. I forgave you a debt that you could never repay at great cost to me. And you can't be merciful to a person who owes you a paltry sum of a week's worth of wages? You are not worthy of the grace and mercy that I have shown to you. Someone came to Jesus and said, Master, how many times must I forgive my brother? 7 times? And he said, no, 70 times 7. In other words, there is never a time that we do not forgive. And if we fail to forgive, we do that to our own dire consequences. So, mercy then is a very important component, or should be, of all of our lives. And so I want to encourage you that in your everyday living, when you encounter people and you have an opportunity to be merciful, whether they did it on their own. Look, just because somebody sinned or did wrong doesn't mean that they don't deserve some consequences. They do. But it's the degree of the consequences that may be in question. And so if it's appropriate and right, we should extend to them mercy. If there are people in our life who can't help themselves, we should extend to them mercy. Why? Because when we do that, we are being merciful as our Father in heaven is merciful. And that is the standard.